Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. Today's topic is Haiti. It's a topic I need to come back to, return to occasionally, because Haiti is so important to me. My guest is Brian Concannon. I must say very quickly that the first major article I ever wrote was on Haiti. I began writing about 3.5 years ago. I wrote 2 short articles as appetizers, as it were. And the first main article I ever wrote was on Haiti. It's called The Sorrows of Haiti, and I reviewed the tragic history of the country. It truly is, for 500 years. Haiti is very important. Most people don't give it a thought. Rarely are there ever any reports on the country in the news, but there should be a great deal more. Let me tell you about Brian and who he is and what he does. Brian is a very distinguished human rights lawyer, and he's the director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. And what they do is they work with grassroots groups to develop an effective human rights advocacy program with global outreach. And it's also active with organizations in the U.S. and with the Haitian diaspora, activists in the Haitian diaspora throughout the world. They promote human rights in Haiti, and the Haitians most certainly deserve them. For 500 years, they've been denied them, except for very brief periods, all too brief. Today, we'll talk about President René Préval. He was elected to a second term in February 2006. He's coming up to his he's past his two-year period, but we want to assess his time in office so far, and we want to talk about prospects for Haiti in the new Obama administration and Congress. Brian, before we jump in a minute or so, we'll take a commercial break. Let me just give listeners a quick snapshot of Haiti. I think listeners to this program know an awful lot more than most people. But very briefly, Haiti sits about midway between South Florida and Venezuela. Square miles, it's about the size of Maryland, has a population approaching 9 million. World Bank has it just a little bit below that. Capital is Port-au-Prince. Country has some minimal mineral wealth, but its main value is its human resource. And I used a line once or twice about the country, talking about corporate giants covet its offshore cheap labor as a paradise for Walmart's always low prices at 11 or 12 cents an hour, maybe even less than that. It's pretty tough to pass up a bargain like that. But it's pretty tough to live on 11 cents an hour. Brian, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Steve. It's great to be here, and it's always great to talk about Haiti with you.
Oh, Brian, it's terrific having you on, and I wish you a belated happy holiday and look forward to the new year. And let's just jump in quickly and get into assessing René Préval. How has he been doing for the past, I guess it's getting close to 3 years now.
Well, he was elected in February of 2006. He should have taken office under the Constitution in February of 2006, but because there was a U.S. sponsored dictatorship there that wasn't giving up power willingly, he didn't start until April. So he's not quite 3 years into his term, but he's a little bit over halfway. So it's a 5-year term, and he's out on February 7th, 2011. So we're a little bit more than halfway. And the question of how he's doing is actually, it's an excellent question. It's a question that if you ask 5 people in the streets of Port-au-Prince, you'll probably get about 7 different answers.
Right, I hate to interrupt you, but that music means a commercial break.
Oh, okay. Indeed,
I momentarily forgot the post-election dispute. I wrote about it 2.5 years ago. There certainly wasn't. Let's take a break and we'll... Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. I'm on with Brian Concannon. We're talking about Haiti. Brian, before you pick it up, let me just mention briefly for listeners that I think no doubt Haiti's best years were through most of the 1990s. Mostly under Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who the more he tried to do to help his own people, the more he was vilified by the dominant media, and they just concocted the most outrageous lies about him. They haven't stopped, but since he's not president anymore, They don't surface too often, but they should during the 1990s. Then Preval in the second half of the decade, and he continued what Aristide did. Then February 2004, the Marines decided that they wanted somebody else to rule Haiti. So they, in the middle of the night, they absconded with Aristide. They kidnapped him, a coup d'etat made in Washington, and they exported him to where he is now in South Africa. He didn't begin in South Africa. Central African Republic, it didn't tell him where he was going, but he's in South Africa now. Haitians want him back badly. The article that I wrote, Brian, back the early, right after the election, a month or so, I think, after the election in 2006, I can't forget the title. I called it René Préval's Impossible Mission, and I think that's a good point to let you pick up. And how impossible has it been?
Well, it hasn't been impossible. It's been difficult. And one of the things, going back to what you mentioned about how in the 90s, Haiti was actually Haiti's pretty much its best time in Haiti's history, is the reality is that democracy works. Haiti had a democracy from 1994 until 2004. During that time, there were two peaceful handovers from one elected president to another, the first and second such peaceful handovers in Haiti's history. Economics went better. The social factors all got better throughout that time. I mean, there were certainly were still remaining problems in Haiti, but throughout that time, there was steady progress across the board in Haiti until that was interrupted. And I'll make one small correction of you. It wasn't the Marines that decided they didn't like President Aristide. It was our president who decided it.
the Marines we used.
The Marines, right. They were the tools, but the decision was made up in the White House.
And, oh, absolutely.
And it was really because we disagreed with the Haitian elected officials' economic policy, which is going to happen. Haiti's a country of poor people, and they're not going to elect somebody that Wall Street would elect or that a wealthy suburban district in the U.S. would elect. They'd elect the same type of people that someone from an inner city, Oakland, California, would elect. And we just have to accept that, just as we accept that maybe that Ron Dellums is mayor, she's not mayor of Oakland, but that, you know, that you have a fairly progressive person as mayor of a lot of inner cities. We're going to have to accept that there's progressives who are going to be elected to high office in countries like Haiti, and we may not like their economic policies, but we also have to accept that if we are serious about democracy, if we are really going to practice what we preach, we're going to have to let that go. And the struggle with Préval goes back to that basic struggle, because we're still not letting Préval govern. To talk a little bit more about the elections, which are important, the elections of 2006 were important to explain the constraints that Préval is under. Because briefly, if we had President Préval on the line, he would say, I was elected with a very progressive left-wing mandate. I've been governing far to the right of that, and I've been doing that because I really have no choice. And the reason he has no choice, part of it is United States, that we're certainly applying a lot of pressure to him towards the right. And there's the example of what happened to the last president in Haiti, who didn't sufficiently knuckle under to U.S. pressure. He got kidnapped, as you said, and sent to the Central African Republic. President Préval is also under a lot of pressure from the elites in his country who have run the country forever, or since independence, and have no interest in seeing their influence wane. And the other thing, he's circumscribed by his own government in three ways. One of them is the justice system. The interim government of Haiti, which was a U.S. imposed dictatorship from 2004 to 2006, they did a good job of packing the justice system. And that's something that Americans are going to have to get used to, where we're going to have a judiciary that's far to the right of our elected officials, because of it was successfully packed by both Bush administrations and the Reagan administration. And we're going to, you know, for a long time, we're going to see our courts be a very strong rightward push on government policies. And Haiti has that problem. In fact, half the Supreme Court was in December of 2005. The interim government just fired half the Supreme Court and replaced it with their own henchmen, which is completely unconstitutional in Haiti. beyond the judicial branch, you also have the legislative branch. And the 2006 elections, although it did lead to the election of President Preval, who's generally recognized as an elected, freely elected president, they were run by the dictatorship. And Preval was not elected freely because there were good elections. He was elected freely despite the interim government's attempts to manipulate the elections to keep people like him out. Legislative candidates were much less successful in overcoming. President Preval had been president before. He had a lot of name recognition. At the legislative level, that did not happen. The party that has won every election in Haiti in which it's contested is the Femme La Valace party. That party boycotted it because their candidates were being put in jail or killed, and they said, well, we're not going to run in the election until the political persecution stopped. The political persecution didn't stop, so they didn't run. Many other progressive candidates tried to run and were intimidated. Even President Preval's own election activities were attacked. Twice they actually destroyed the platform he was going to speak from. He had to cancel his big wrap-up rally at the end of the election campaign. He just couldn't even have it because it was too dangerous. And so in that context, the right-wing candidates got elected who did not have a chance of winning a fair election in Haiti. And so they are a very strong rightward push on President Preval. The third rightward push within the government is his own government itself. Under Haiti's constitution, the president is fairly limited in power. The ministries and the kind of the day-to-day process are run by ministers and a prime minister. The prime minister is chosen from the president but needs approval of parliament. And so you need to, in Haiti's case, you need to cobble together a government, not really, and because Haiti's political parties are so refracted, and Femme La Valace, which has always won the elections, is not represented in parliament. You've got a situation where they've had to cobble together a government, not necessarily along ideological lines, but as a way, they cobble the government together in a way to get the votes to get the government approved. And so that also is very right, a rightward push on the government. So in terms of what President Preval has doing, on the plus side, the government basically functions. The organizing is possible. There is not any continued jailing of dissidents. There aren't crackdown on demonstrations. The people are able to more or less exercise their basic individual rights. And so that is all positive. And that's something that we can most of the time take advantage take for granted in the U.S., but it's something in Haiti that's actually fairly rare.
Let me stop you one moment, because by my way of judging the situation in the country, there are so-called U.N. blue helmet peacekeepers that do anything but keep the peace. It's a very repressive force. I don't think it's any different today than when I wrote about it in an article I called U.N. blue helmet I forget my title, but I refer to them as paramilitary. UN Blue Helmet Paramilitaries, I guess, was my title. And along with the Haitian police, they routinely conducted, and I imagine still do, some pretty brutal crackdowns on the people of Haiti, including standing up to some of the public demonstrations. Aren't those things still going on?
They're still going on, but even that situation is improving. The MINUSTAH, which is the UN peacekeeping mission, going back again, MINUSTAH was established following the February 29, 2004 coup d'etat. It's the only mission in the UN's history where they sent a peacekeeping mission where there wasn't a peace agreement to enforce. They really sent it to consolidate the coup d'etat. It was a way of the UN making up to President Bush for resisting him on Iraq. They said, okay, here we can agree on sending a completely imperialist force to Haiti. The UN, in its first 2 years, the UN was routinely brutal and was involved in outright political oppression, arresting top political dissidents, including several that we've represented in both Haitian and international courts. They would often secure the perimeter of an area and let the Haitian police go in and start shooting people up. They did some of their own extrajudicial executions. There was one raid where they shot 27,000 bullets in a single raid in a poor neighborhood. That was certainly brutal. That brutality has decreased quite a bit under President Prevost. It has certainly not been eliminated, but over the course of the 2.5 years of President Prevost's mandate, it has fairly steadily decreased. Not to defend MINUSTAH, it shouldn't be there. The UN has no business doing what it was doing. The Haitian people say we want the international community's help doing agricultural ditches and building roads, not shooting bullets. But that situation has improved as well, and I think President Prevost gets some credit for that. He can't completely resist the MINUSTAH and the UN and the international community, but he's done a somewhat of a decent job of putting pressure on them to put less emphasis into bullets and more emphasis into development.
We have another break coming up, but let me pose a question and you can answer it when we come back. What justification is there for a peacekeeping force to be in a country in which there was no war aside for supporting a coup d'etat? Peacekeepers go in to support the peace. What justification allows MINUSTAH to stay there in the first place?
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm talking about Haiti with Brian Concannon. Brian, I guess there's no dispute that there certainly was a lot of disruption leading up to the 2004 coup. But again, that was made in Washington. But as you say, things have settled down. So why on earth does René Préval, I think I used the wrong term in perpetuity, but why does René Préval want to maintain UN peacekeepers, at least for a considerable period of time?
Well, he's not going to say this, but my guess is that he doesn't, that he simply has no choice, that he knows what happened to the last president of Haiti who stood up to the international community. The public statements that Préval has said, and he says this every time that MINUSTAH's mandate is renewed, which it comes up in October of every year, and every single time he says, we'd like the UN to do more building roads and fixing irrigation ditches than patrolling the streets in armored vehicles. That happens to a slight extent, but not nearly to the extent that President Préval, the president of the country, is requesting the UN to do. The justification for MINUSTAH now is very similar to the justification for U.S. forces in Iraq. In both cases, the foreign forces were a large part of creating the problem. In Haiti, they helped consolidate the coup d'etat, and the interim government of Haiti eviscerated the police. They took out good police officers because they were considered loyal to the democratic governments. Some of them were arrested, some were killed, and they were replaced to a large extent by paramilitaries who and former soldiers of Haiti's army. And as a result, the police force itself did in fact become incapable of maintaining order in the country. The question is, what the UN would say now is that is still the case, that and that it needs to be there, just as the U.S. would say there. And some Haitians might agree. Even most Haitians would completely disagree with that the UN should be there in perpetuity and would say that they should immediately be working on getting out. But I think most Haitians would say if they left tomorrow, you would have a drastic increase in crime. The problem is that...
Haven't there been rallies, public protests against MINUSTAH, where people really want them out of the country? I don't know about tomorrow, but they really feel oppressed by MINUSTAH around, and they don't want them.
Again, it's like Iraq. I mean, if you ask most Haitian people, they would say, yes, we don't want them, and we want them out. They probably wouldn't say... Like Iraq, a lot of people would say they should leave right now, but also a lot of people would say they should stay to maintain some order. The problem, though, is that's MINUSTAH, as the U.S. troops in Iraq are doing, is they're kind of creating a demand for their services in perpetuity, and that's what is the most frustrating to the Haitian people, is that they don't see the U.N. moving on, and there's not even a fight over the renewal of the mandate. one thing, yeah, another thing, and this is it's sad that anybody has to think this way, but another advantage to President Preval is that as long as there's a peacekeeping force, there won't be a foreign-supported coup d'etat against him. And it's crazy logic, but unfortunately, in Haiti, that logic works. If you go back to the 90s, the time we were talking about where there was almost a 10-year interval of democracy, for over half that time, there actually was a UN peacekeeping mission in Haiti. That was a legal peacekeeping mission. It had been requested by President Aristide back in 1994. And it was not as controversial because it wasn't shooting people. It was actually doing peacekeeping work of just keeping a coup d'etat from happening. And I think that's something that President Preval unfortunately has to think about, because once that UN force was removed, the U.S. started sending its soldiers over the border to attack the Haitian government. And the part of the message, and this is a message being sent not just to Haiti, because Haiti, you talked about the importance of Haiti in the overall scheme of things in the U.S. Haiti's often, in the media, it's often talked about as being peripheral. But in fact, Haiti's often very central to U.S. policy. We spend enormous resources, and we've always have spent enormous resources into controlling Haiti, because we've always made Haiti an example to other countries. And the reason why we keep spending so much money for UN or U.S. forces in Haiti is that we want to show to the rest of the small countries in Latin America, if you step out of line, this is what happens to you. And it works. The other countries in Latin America understand what happens when you step out of line. They don't want to end up like Haiti, and so they will toe the line. I mean, you don't see El Salvador or even Nicaragua confronting the U.S. the same way that Haitian officials will.
Right. It's also a race to the bottom that if you can pay Haitian labor 11 or 12 cents an hour, then the people in the region and other countries, you can get away with paying them wages that maybe aren't too much different from that. But if Haitians should get, if Haitians' wages doubled, then that would reverberate throughout the whole region. So it's in the interest of Washington and the big corporate interests to be sure that never happens.
Exactly.
We want to talk about the Obama administration. We'll do that in the second half of the hour, but we can continue this after the break, Brian. But when the interim La Tortue government came in, it instantly annulled all of the Aristide changes for the better, the beneficial social changes. Has Preval been able to do anything whatsoever to restore even a smidgen of those? And we have another break coming up, but maybe after the break, you can explain whether he's been able to do anything at all, even in small measure. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Brian Concannon. We're talking about Haiti. Has Preval been able to do anything on the plus side for the Haitian people along the lines of what happened during the 1990s when he and Aristide were president?
He has. The rep, and he's increased spending on education. He's done some improvements in health, clean water, roads, projects that are very important to the average Haitian. But I think the rap against Preval and what people would criticize him for, and you know, I've been explaining that Preval is under a lot of constraints, and I think it's essential to understand in the situation that he is under constraints. But many people in Haiti would agree that he's under these constraints, but would say he still has more room to do. He has room to do more than he is, and that he's letting the constraints hold him back more than he should. And that would be the critique of him in terms of social programs, in terms of reestablishing what the previous government had done. One of the things that Preval, that people are clearly pointing out to is problematic by Preval is who he's appointing to a lot of mid-level and low-level posts. And he doesn't always have a great choice of who he appoints to be a minister level, but he certainly could get people into to lower level posts.
And about the new prime minister, Michelle Pierre-Louise, have I got it right?
Yes, Michelle Pierre-Louise is the new prime minister, and she comes from, I would say, sort of a center, maybe center left background. She worked for George Soros's Open Society Institute for a long time, and she is generally considered to be Preval's choice, although again her ministers are very much a compromise. But where people see Preval, where people really criticize Preval from the grassroots perspective, is they say he's not giving any of us jobs. People especially from the Lavalas movement, we were involved in running some of these government bureaucracies. We know how to staff them. We know how to make these programs work. But instead, Preval is giving these jobs to other people, many of them from political perspectives that are not supportive of the programs, in the same way that you have in the United States under the Bush administration, people running programs that they disagree with, and obviously they don't do a good job because of that. In Haiti, you have the same thing. You have people who are kind of anti-government people running government programs, and with a similar result of them not having them work as well as they should.
But again, Brian, as you say, he's under tremendous constraints, and I absolutely agree with you. I personally want to be critical of Preval, and I like to make the comment that if he couldn't get the job done right, then why did he take it in the first place? But I understand that to a large extent he's operating with a gun to his head, and if he goes too far, then the same thing will happen to him as happened to Aristide. So he wants to, I guess, move in baby steps to do something rather than have a La Tortue government come back and do absolutely nothing. So a tiny bit, a few percent, is better than no percent at all. So I do respect that.
And within Haiti, most of his critics, especially his critics from the left, which is the vast majority of the Haitian population, they're careful when they talk about their critiques of him to not make it a critique that could be used as a justification to overthrow him. They'll start off saying, he's our president. We want him to remain president for his term, as the Constitution says. But we don't like this policy, and we think this policy should be changed. And so from the perspective of an American who's working on issues in Haiti, we're also very careful about always recognizing that President Preval is the president, and he was elected by the Haitian people, and they're the ones who can decide, is he a good president or is he a bad president. But what we do is we stick to particular issues that we feel that there is a legitimacy to the critique and support Haitian grassroots groups that are saying there's a critique. And in many ways, it's a loyal opposition. It's sort of saying, okay, we generally support President Preval, but we know he's getting a lot of pressure from the right. We need to do some pushback from the left to even things out.
Okay.
And a lot of this is what progressives are going to be struggling with under the Obama administration. You know, certainly there's limits. Obama was on the record from the beginning of how limited he is in terms of being a progressive, but I think that the challenge of the progressive movement in the United States is to successfully push back against the huge amount of pressure he's going to get from the right to try to get policies that are not too right wing.
I think you've seen some of the articles that I've written about Obama, and it expresses my great concern as to what I see coming. I very much want your opinions, but very, very sadly, he represents so much hope for so many people in this country. It's beyond a racial issue. Race doesn't even matter. It's a guy that they see as somebody who's just the antithesis of George Bush, and I'm afraid, from my assessment, I want to call him George Bush's third term. I put out a major article today. I sent it to you this morning, Brian. You'll spot it if you haven't already. It's on the terrible situation in Gaza. I spent all weekend on it. Just an outrageous story. But I included a couple of quotes from Obama. He's on vacation now in Hawaii. And I included a quote of what he said about the Hamas government, the democratically elected government of occupied Palestine. And it was an absolutely outrageous quote, what he said about them. It was just full of lies. It was absolutely full of lies. If I didn't know Obama said it, Brian, I would have thought this came out of the mouth of George Bush. It just was an outrageous set of things that he said about them, and it's in my article. I'm very concerned, but I'm curious what you have to say about him.
I agree with you, and I think one of the interesting things, and one of the challenges that progressives are going to have, especially on foreign policy, is that both candidates running for president talked about the need to break from policies of the past. And the question is whether it's breaking from the policies of the past 8 years or the past 200 years. And when you look at, Palestine and Haiti are both great examples, is that there are certainly, you can point to the 2004 coup d'etat in Haiti, where the president was kidnapped, and obviously that's kind of a high water mark of U.S. injustice to Haiti. And obviously there's plenty of things in the Middle East you can point to where the George Bush administration did things that were much worse than previous administrations. But in both cases, those were exaggerations of existing policies rather than complete political anomalies. And I think that's the problem, whereas Barack Obama might admit that the war in Iraq was a mistake, he's not ready to take on the consensus of the foreign policy community in the United States that has led to was it 60 years of very bad policies towards Israel. And in the same sense, in Haiti, our policy's always been racist. It's always been putting the short-term needs of U.S. interests above both the needs of Haiti, but also of the long-term needs of the U.S. In the same way that our policy towards Israel is costing us money and lives and peace in the whole world, our policies to Haiti have been extremely counterproductive in the long run to the United States. And so I think that the challenge of all of us who are working for a more constructive U.S. foreign policy is to make sure the debate goes beyond, are we just not going to repeat the worst errors of the Bush administration, or are we going to really reform U.S. foreign policy to have something that's much more constructive and likely to advance both the interests of other countries in the world, but also our own long-term interests.
Well, and Brian, I agree with you. I agree with you so strongly, and I've said so many times in so many different ways in my articles that change never comes from the top down. It's always from the bottom up. If enough people put enough effort into working for constructive change, that's the way it sometimes happens. And there have been some amazing things that have happened in the history of the U.S., and we ended slavery. We had a glorious civil rights movement, a glorious labor movement. These things have, to a great extent, dwindled away. But if we did it before, why can't we do it again? I think one other thing you may be saying is that it could be that Barack Obama will end up becoming America's Rene Preval.
Yeah, but he's not going to be able to say, okay, we're immediately going to recognize Palestine. I mean, he can't do that today. Nor is he going to say we're going to end 200 years of racist treatment of Haiti. But I think he can make some changes, and I think there's also lots of opportunities that if you just focus it on who's Secretary of State, that you're going to miss. One of the opportunities, and I was in Washington last month, and I was really excited by how many progressives were there and excited and talking about their friends who were working, who were trying to get a job in the Obama administration. And you're going to get, I think, the very top-level people, and again, this is similar to the Haitian government, the top-level people are going to be compromise candidates, and they're going to be people who are much towards the center or the right than progressives would like. But down the line, there's going to be more progressive people, and that's going to provide opportunities. We've also got opportunities in Congress. There's a much stronger Democratic majority in the House and in the Senate, and you've got people who have been in Haiti, been longtime supporters of justice in Haiti and sovereignty for Haiti, who are starting to move up to more and more powerful positions every election. Another thing that's vitally important that we can't forget is we have tools now that we didn't have at the last presidential transition. There was no Republic News Hour in 2001. We've got all sorts of web-based tools from websites to Facebook pages. And my organization, IJDH, has a Friends of IJDH Facebook page, which we didn't have 6 months ago, and it's a way of getting very quick information out to people rapidly. There's all sorts of structures that have been established by people who, throughout the Bush administration, and particularly on Haiti, where we saw, you know, when the coup happened in Haiti, we said, how did this happen? How did things get so bad that the U.S. government was able to kidnap a Haitian president and nobody complained about it? And our conclusion was, well, we let it happen, that we weren't organizing, that we didn't establish structures to prevent this from happening. And so our response was, we're establishing structures. And this goes across the board. It's not just Haiti. It's environment, it's foreign policy, it's Israel policy, energy policy. People are organized in ways that they've never been in my lifetime. And I think that, in the end, as you said, it's not going to be a top-down thing. It's going to be because the people insist on change, and that's going to make the change happen.
And it takes time, Brian. I agree with you that more and more people rely more and more online for their information. I saw something very briefly, a survey was done. It had good news and bad news. People relying much more online for information, hopefully programs like this, websites, than major newspapers. And that's a good sign. The bad sign was the same survey said that they rate television their main source of news and information. Well, that's about the worst place to go for news and information, unless you've got community stations or you're lucky enough to have an off channel like Free Speech TV, which with my 300 odd channels in Chicago, Brian, we do not have Free Speech TV, so we don't get that kind of programming. And you certainly can't find out what's going on by watching CNN or CBS or NBC or heaven forbid, Fox News. I mean, it's just appalling what they pass off as news and information. People need to realize that. And I like to talk about, there's an easy way to beat those people. I mean, we don't have the financial resources, but the way to beat them that they have no defense against is to ignore them. There's nothing they can do about that. So people need to know what's happening, not to be well-informed, which I like to say often. It's to do it in our own self-interest, and if we don't look after ourselves, who will? So we need to protect ourselves, and we're also going through a terrible economic situation right now. And my own feeling is it'll get a lot bleaker before it ever gets better, and it'll be around for a very, very long time. And the people, the most vulnerable people, will be hurt very, very severely. So more and more people will be impoverished right here in the U.S., and we'll have communities here that may not be as impoverished as Haitians, but they can be in very dire shape, Brian. I can walk to a housing project from where I live, a mile or so from where I live, and there are people who don't eat three meals a day because they can't afford to pay for it. That's pretty tough stuff.
Yes, and I think one sign of hope coming out of that is people are starting to realize that there's a fundamental problem. I think over the last at least 10 or 15 years, most of the political discourse has been about tinkering, trying to make a small change to our policies. And I think that there's, when you look at the war in Iraq and the financial crisis and the environmental crises, they're starting to add up to the point where people are saying, hey, there's something wrong here, and they're starting to look at new ways of addressing it. And, you know, even the word crisis, it's often used in purely pejorative sense of crisis being a negative thing. But if you look at both the etymology of crisis in our own language, and also if you look at the Chinese, I always like this, the Chinese character for crisis is two characters, one superimposed on the other, and it's a character for danger, but also superimposed on that is the character for opportunity. And I think that that's a very good metaphor. It's been a very accurate metaphor for Haiti, which always seems to be in a crisis with both dangers and opportunities. And I think we're in a similar place in the United States where the danger part is obviously easy to see, reading the financial news, looking at the real estate market, looking at the environment, looking at all the wars we're losing. But it's also there are opportunities in there, and I think the very conditions that create the dangers create opportunities for us to get organized to develop a more sustainable and legal and just political and social structure.
Brian, I agree. Maybe the old saying, it's darkest before the dawn, and maybe on the other side of what we're going through, plus all of the terrible things that took place under 8 years of George Bush, the terrible homeland repression, people forget these things. Again, I think far less people who listen to this program, but we've still got the Patriot Act around, Homeland Security that I refer to, I think very accurately, as the National Gestapo. I've written a fair amount on what they've done to our immigrant population from south of the border, not from north of the border, but from south of the border. I mean brutal repression of these people, except the ones they want to keep around to be exploited as cheap labor with absolutely no rights whatsoever. But we didn't have this stuff back in the 1990s, and we have it now. And I can't imagine that Obama is just going to come in and sweep this away. So I think for the time being we're stuck with it. But this is a terrible dilemma that we have to deal with, and we have to get people elected in government, and we need a leader at the top who at some point has enough power and enough courage to decide that this is not the America that these people want to lead. They want an America that really isn't America, so we're a long way from that. Oh, dear, we have another break we have to take. Let's do that, and the hour flies by, Brian, as it always does. We'll finish it up, and I'll let you have full say during the last segment. Welcome back. I'm on with Brian Concannon. Brian, it's a big world out there, but like for you, Haiti is very important to me, and I hope just maybe, Obama, being a black man, that he'll feel a little bit more kindly toward Haiti than a good old boy from Texas who I'm not certain he even knew where Haiti was. You take over. Oh, do one other thing as well. Give listeners your website, the website for the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, so they can visit the site, they can get information, and you certainly have a lot of it there.
Sure. You know, one of the things I really like about your show, Steve, is that you have so many people who are involved in organizing for change. And I'm looking forward. Is Marjorie Cohn coming tomorrow?
Oh, she is. President of the National Lawyers Guild, law professor in San Diego. And we're going to talk about prospect for social justice under Barack Obama.
And I'll be really excited to listen to that show. And you know, a lot of your guests are really doing great work in organizing. And I think that's vitally important. And I just encourage all your listeners to get involved, find the issue that speaks to them. Haiti speaks to me, and that's why I'm involved in Haiti. I think it's fundamental both to help Haitians and to help the U.S. But pick an issue or a set of issues that really you really get excited about, and just get involved. If Haiti is your issue, we've got a program to make it easy for you to get involved. We've got our website is www.haitijustice.org, and we've got a lot of information about human rights. In Haiti, we put links up to the best articles, so you just come to visit the front page of our website, and you'll get the best articles that come out, on Haiti over the course of the week. We also have a program called the Half Hour for Haiti program, where it's specifically designed for busy people who don't have a huge amount of time to stay and, to keep up on Haiti, but we provide you the information you need to keep up to date on what's going on in Haiti and to take action regarding Haiti, all in half an hour a week or less. Actually, it started off every week. Now we're about one to two times a month we send out an alert, and it's always got a very quick update on what's going on in Haiti, as well as an action that you can do to make Haiti a more just place and to make the U.S. a just place. The types of issues that we're going to be addressing under the new administration include debt relief for Haiti. Right now, Haiti's paying $1 million a week to the World Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank, and we aim to stop that. Another issue is immigration fairness, and we didn't have time to talk about this, but Haitians are discriminated against. Immigrants are generally treated poorly in the United States. Haitian immigrants are treated poorly than almost any other national origin group. Another issue that we're working on is trade. One of the reasons why Haiti was hit very hard by the food crisis Haiti has the capacity to produce a lot of its food, but we actually eliminated that capacity through our trade policies back in the 80s and ever since then. So those are all issues we're going to focus on in the new year, because we think that there's opportunities to make a very concrete improvement in Haitians' lives through leveraging our voice to get a more constructive U.S. policy. And so I'd encourage people to sign up for that and to visit our website.
Oh, I think all of that is so important, Brian. And I would add that what goes on in Haiti is a microcosm for what goes on all over the world. And it really creeps right up into the U.S. because, again, there are people here that face terrible poverty issues, terrible deprivation, terrible human rights abuses. So Haiti is not one world and America a different world. It crosses over to a disturbing extent, and what happens in one place can very easily move into another.
So Haitians call themselves a laboratory. They say that nefarious policies are tried out in Haiti and then exported to the rest of the world, including the U.S.
Oh, indeed.
That does happen regularly.
That music means the program is over. Let me just thank you again for coming on. Can I leave it by saying to be continued?
I'd be happy to join you, and thanks for covering Haiti, and thanks for inviting me anytime. I'm happy to come on and talk to you.
Oh, thanks, Brian. My great thanks to you, of course, for coming on.
Okay, best of luck with the new year.